The number required is the square root of 1% of a given population. The square root of 1% of a given population. What does that mean? It means if you take 1% of the people in a room, in your living room or an auditorium, or you take 1% of the people in a community or a village or a nation or the earth, and you take the square root of that number, that tells you how many people are required in consciousness to achieve that state of peace inside their bodies before that peace is mirrored and reflected in the world around them. And they're very small numbers. They may surprise you. For example, in a city of 1 million people, the square root of 1% of 1 million people is only about 100 people. In a world of 6 billion people, the square root of 1% of that number is only about 8,000 people. 8,000 people. Now, this is the threshold, the minimum number required to kind of jumpstart the effects. Obviously, the more people that are involved, the more accelerated the effects. So I'm sharing these statistics with you to really anchor into our awareness that the way we feel in every moment and every day about ourselves and our relationship to our world, it is key in the way that world is mirrored back to us and the way that we affect and participate in the events of our lives. Our relationship to the field offers us a tremendously empowering new perspective regarding our ability to create and bring about lasting change in our world. Just as we've all heard so many times in the past from so many spiritual traditions, what these studies are showing is the change that we choose to experience in our world has to begin inside of us, and it has to begin inside of us in a way that is consistent and real and tangible. This is leading to an entirely new science, a new spirituality. Dr. John Wheeler from Princeton University, he's a physicist and a colleague of Albert Einstein, Niels Bohr, is doing some very, very far-reaching, pioneering work in understanding the implications of this field. And what Dr. Wheeler says to us, this is amazing, this is a quote. He says, from his studies now, he believes that we are part of a universe that is a work still in progress. He says the universe isn't finished yet. He says we're tiny patches of the universe looking at itself, and here's the key, building itself along the way. In other words, what he's saying is that consciousness, rather than being the byproduct of a universe that's already created, he's saying that consciousness is what's actually creating in our universe. This implies that when we look to the very edges of creation, we want to know where the boundaries of the universe exist, we may never find those boundaries. Because the act of looking puts something there for us to see. When we look into the world, the minute world of the quantum atom, and we see the effects of the particles and so many different kinds of particles, the quarks and the leptons, the muons, gravitons, all the ons that physicists now are using to describe our world. What this suggests is that we cannot purely observe our world. That those particles are, why is it that sometimes matter responds as light? Sometimes it responds as a particle. This is one of the great mysteries in physics. Is it because of the consciousness and the way that we are looking at these things? There were a series of studies that were done in the 1980s. Remember the promise of cold fusion as our answer to the energy problems, especially after the oil embargoes in the mid-1970s. Cold fusion was the process that was believed to put out more energy than it took to create it. All of a sudden, we don't hear much about cold fusion anymore. What happened to it? What happened to cold fusion? Well, of the many things that happened, one of the interesting things was that observers and scientists found that using the same equipment in the same laboratory, they could not get the same results. Sometimes the process would work beautifully. Sometimes it wouldn't work at all. And they had to ask themselves the question, why is it? Why don't these experiments result in predictable, repeatable outcomes time after time. There is a story of one particularly astute researcher over the lunch table one day that made an observation. It's an anecdotal story. I've never been able to trace it back to the original source, and I've heard it so many times, I'm going to share it with you. What this researcher asked is this. He said, why is it that I notice this pattern? He said, when the researchers in the room are advocates of cold fusion and they believe in the process, why is it that more often than not the process is successful? And when the researchers in the room are skeptics and they don't believe in it, why is it that more often than not the experiment fails? And this led to a series of experiments, according to the stories, that helped scientists understand, although they don't fully understand the process, they recognized the expectation of the people in the room. The feeling of the success or the failure for the experiment somehow is playing a role in the experiment itself. It's precisely what John Wheeler says. He says, we can't simply observe our universe. We're participating in it through the act of being conscious beings. And he has coined the term. He says now he suspects we live in what is called a participatory universe. I love this concept. The key to healing and abundance, success, and peace in a participatory universe is simply this. And this is the key to our entire program today. If there's one thing that the message in ourselves may help us to come to terms with, is it empowers us in our lives to become the very things that we choose to experience in our world. We must become in our lives the very things that we choose to experience in our world. If we choose love, nurturing, abundance, gratitude from others, we must first embody those very things in our lives, in our personal day-to-day activities, so that the field can carry that effect and mirror them back to us in our experiences. How can we expect to have love and nurturing and gratitude if we are feeling angry and stressed and the tension that so many people report feeling as a result of their daily routines? We must become the things in our lives, the things that we experience in our world. 500 years before the time of Jesus, a man walked the earth, and his name was Buddha. I know you've heard of Buddha. What was his message? What was the essence of Buddha's message? He said to us, in the language of his time, he left us the keys to a very powerful internal technology. He said, if you can live your lives in compassion, gratitude, and love, what he said is, you're going to change your body. And when you change your body, you'll change your world. 500 years after the time of Buddha, another man walked the earth, and his name was Jesus of Nazareth. Regardless of what we may feel or how you feel about what has become of his teachings, the essence of the texts that he left behind simply say the same thing, and that's all they say. The essence of Jesus' teaching. He said, in your life, you who will come in my future, if you can live your lives in compassion, gratitude, and love, honor one another, he said, you'll change your body. And when you do that, you're going to change your world. And now we're beginning to develop the language in our time, the science that tells us precisely the same thing, and it describes how this tradition actually works. Early in the 20th century, scientists began to unearth a previously unknown civilization in the areas that today are known as northern India and Pakistan. Two cities in particular were discovered first, and these have led to the discoveries of additional cities that are older than anything we believed was existing in terms of civilization in this part of the world. The cities Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa, for example, are now dated right around 5,000 years old. Other cities believed to be even older now have been found in this area known as the Hindus Valley. Well, the cities are amazing for a number of reasons, because we're finding things in these cities that should not be there with respect to what we've believed to be the chronology and the sequence of our past and the way that technology has developed. These cities were amazingly advanced. They had art. They had glass, stained glass that they used for windows and they used in their art. Amazing architecture and the planning of the city streets. all of the cities were based on grids that are tied into the number 108 or multiples of the number 108. They had hot and cold running water. They appear to have closed sewage systems, and some even show evidence of cable, perhaps electrical cable, running in pipes under the ground. They had an advanced form of writing. They tried to tell us who they were and what was happening to them, and to this day, we have never been able to translate their text. It's called Indus Valley Script. To the best of my knowledge, as of the writing of the book in early 2002 in this program in 2005, this text has never been translated. We don't know what they said to us. So the question is, what happened to them? How is it that civilizations so advanced, so sophisticated, could have existed so long ago and utterly disappeared from the face of the earth with no trace or no memory for thousands of years until archaeologists began to recover them early in the 20th century? How can that happen? One of the great mysteries is that for many years, this particular area has seen a high concentration of birth defects in the children of people who live around this area. They've never really known why. It was in the early 1990s when there was housing that was being built in this area. So interesting that housing would be built in an area where there were a high degree of birth defects, but they didn't know what was causing it.